But the notion of transparency and freedom in the relationship, you say that he was asked how he coped with all his women once, and he says, "I lie to them. It's easier and more decent." And do you lie to all of them? He smiles, to all of them, even to the beaver, which is what he calls Simone de Beauvoir. Particularly to the beaver, he says. So
yes,
where does this leave us?
That's the one remark, I found in all the papers, letters, journals and so on that I looked at, that was a bit of a betrayal of Simone de Beauvoir. Generally, he wrote letters to other girlfriends and was bitchy about everybody, but never Simone de Beauvoir. That remark hurt her, I know, because the man, Olivier Todd, who quotes that, apparently got a letter from Simone de Beauvoir saying how enraged she was. So, you know, it wasn't the best thing for him to say. I suspect, by the way, it's not really true. He might have told little lies to Simone de Beauvoir. I know, for example, we do know, I talk about this in the book, that he was something of an alcoholic at the end of his life. Well before the end, he drank quantities, enormous quantities of whiskey, and took a lot of speed, and then he took 5 heavy sleeping pills to wind himself down and get himself to sleep, and then the next morning he started it all up again. And the thing was that he did hide to Simone de Beauvoir. He was hiding whiskey bottles behind his bookcase, and other girlfriends were smuggling in these whiskey bottles. She was extremely upset by that because she knew that he was virtually killing himself. Those sorts of lies were the lies that he told Beauvoir. You know, in later life, unfortunately, she became a bit of a mother figure to this naughty little boy who was hiding his whiskey bottles. But generally, I don't think he did lie to Beauvoir much.
Let's just talk about their circle, because you describe their circle of friends, people who came to see them at the cafe that they would hold court in, and the friends had to know that when the time was up, they had to sort of disappear because somebody else was arriving at the table. I mean, they were sort of a royal court, weren't they?
I mean, they believed in freedom. Nothing was more important than freedom. But this did not in any way include spontaneity. You know, often Beauvoir and Sartre were living in a hotel on different floors of the same hotel, or eventually they moved in the 1950s into apartments rented usually near each other. But their social life was strictly scheduled, just like a sort of dental clinic. You know, you meet Olga from lunch from 1 until 3, then you work again until 8 at night, and then you meet Vanda, and lunch tomorrow will be with Beauvoir. It was penciled in, scheduled in, and it was tête-à-tête, which is why I call my book Tête-à-tête. It was always these twosomes, and you know, it was never the case that if you were sitting in a cafe, if Sartre was sitting in a cafe with Olga, that Beauvoir could just walk over and join them. That was strictly taboo. It was strict twosomes with strict timelines and, of course, all arranged around their work, which was the most important thing. 8 hours a day of uninterrupted work.
On ABC Radio National, this is Books and Writing. I'm Ramona Koval, and I'm speaking with Hazel Rowley, the author of Tête-à-Tête, The Lives and Loves of Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre. If Sartre had plenty of arrangements with other women throughout his life, Simone de Beauvoir had her fair share of affairs too, and with women as well as with men, although that was something she always denied.
She denied for her whole life that she actually had affairs with women. And that was rather a surprise when her letters to Sartre were published after her death, to find out that, you know, she had had a good sexual relationship with several women. I don't know really quite why she denied that. Maybe it was just too much of a bombshell for France to take, you know. They had quite a lot to take already. And there comes a point when you lose your authority by telling the world too much about yourself. Possibly it was that. Possibly it was that other women were implicated and they didn't want to be publicly implicated. But in any event, yes, throughout her life she denied that, and she certainly did have affairs with women.
And sometimes women who went on to be Sartre's lovers.
Yes, and sometimes at the same time, yes.
So, I mean, where was the sort of element of the idea of jealousy at all manifesting in these relationships?
Well, what was so interesting about Beauvoir and Sartre is that they really were trying to invent a relationship. You know, their view as existentialist philosophers was that, you know, we're born into this grid of social conventions, which are merely social conventions, and let's question them. Let's challenge everything. They also didn't believe in human nature, so that they didn't believe that, you know, one is lazy or that one is different as a woman from a man. One is what one sets out to do. And so they invented this relationship, and they believed that jealousy is natural, but it's not good, and that it's one of the things that you can work on and that you should work on. You know, it is, after all, just an emotion, and we have willpower, which makes us either indulge emotions or try to get the better of them. So they worked on jealousy, and Beauvoir worked on her jealousy throughout her life, because she was often jealous of Sartre and his girlfriends.
Because she wanted to be, you know, the major person, and in fact she did try to organise everything, really, with him. And presumably as long as she knew everything, she was okay, but if he was having any arrangements that she didn't know about, then this meant that there was a lack of control, really.
Yes, I think you're right. I think that knowing ultimately meant control, because he was confiding in her and there was a complicity between them. And often he used to, you know, bitch about them, as I say. And therefore she felt that she had some control. But, you know, there were times nevertheless when it was very hard. He was really in love with the woman, the French woman who he met in New York just after the war. I think that was probably the most difficult time of all.
But why did he keep saying he was going to marry these women? This was this sort of extraordinary thing that you write about. I mean, there's this man. Why didn't they just read what he'd written for a start? Then they'd know that he wasn't actually promising what he could deliver. But he kept having these little relationships where he'd sort of promised very conventional things. He wanted them to be his wife, and they all thought this was a really fabulous idea. A lot of them were very neurotic. A lot of them seemed to be very, you know, what were those actresses who never got another job in their whole life other than the one where he wrote a play for them and put them in the play to act in it? I mean, what kind
of
women
were
they?
Well, that's a good question. I think it was part of Sartre's need to feel in control, and sometimes I think Sartre verged on madness, you know, all this alcohol and speed that he took and the manic way he worked. He was definitely fighting demons, and part of his need to exert some control over his environment was to exert power over women, and he really chose women who were, he called them drowning women. He said he had a tremendous attraction for drowning women, and these were these rather neurotic little women, often actresses, very beautiful always, who he took under his wing, and he made them financially dependent on him, and he wrote plays for them, which they weren't always up to, I might say, because the roles were very demanding. And so he was sort of doing them a favour and not doing them a favour, but he was certainly making them depend on him, which was a power thing for him, wasn't it?
He had difficulty being alone, and this is kind of amazing given his sort of philosophical, you know, ideas. About,
that's true, isn't it?
Tell me about that. Where does it leave existentialism? I mean, this whole life and this whole application of the theory to the practice.
Well, existentialism is really about choosing the life you lead. It's about making choices. It's about freedom. Sartre became, as a Marxist, increasingly aware that our freedom is in many ways, you know, curtailed by social conditions. But we nevertheless, he would argue, always have an element of freedom that we should use responsibly, whether that's in political action, which Sartre did a lot, or whether that's in other ways. And I think, you know, looking back on his life, he did in many ways act out his existentialism relatively well. I mean, yes, I'm not trying to cover up the fact that he told a lot of lies to a lot of women. I don't in any way want to whitewash him. But he did invent a relationship. He did have remarkable generosity towards people. I mean, everybody, friends and women and so on, he just gave his money away. He died a pauper, and he was a really very well-off man. He the minute he had money, he gave it to somebody. He gave a great deal to the third world, and to he gave his life to his work, and his work increasingly became political. So I think he was a man who lived out his belief that an existentialist intellectual should be committed, should take stands, and should invent his own life. I think he did those things.
How